Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Workforce Labor Economic Development Finance Policy Committee here this morning. My name is Dave Baker, along with Co-Chair Pinto. We are going to move forward with the minutes or the meeting of today. Today is April 9th, 2026. We had a meeting yesterday looking for an approval from our Vice Chair for yesterday's minutes. Vice Chair Mecklen, any comments to the minutes?
Yes, Chair Baker. It says on here that yesterday was the 46th meeting, which I believe it would have been the 45th, because the 44th would have been the Thursday before we went on break. There was no 45th on Tuesday because we didn't have this. So if we could make that change.
So you're approving the minutes as amended, I think, is what we'll do. That's a good catch. Thank you very much for that. Appreciate that. Any further comments or questions on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor passing the minutes as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Those minutes are carried. Thank you very much. Today, members, we've got a couple of bills in front of us today. And then we'll have a deed presentation regarding the Promise Act after the first couple of bills. So with that, I'd like to welcome Chair Kreshet to the table. If you'd want to move forward, the chair will move House File 3217 to be laid over today. There may be an amendment to this, but I want to welcome, again, Chair Kreshet to the Committee of Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development. We've got an interesting bill today, so look at your packets, folks. Welcome, Representative Kreshet, and proceed with your bill, House File 3217.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have the A1 amendment. If I could move that as an author's amendment?
You sure can.
Can't move it. But.
Yes, the chair will move the amendment for you. I don't have it. Let's see, what's it dated? What's it numbered? A1 amendment. Thank you. Members, any questions about the A1 to put the bill in the shape the author would require, would request? Hearing none. All those in favor, but signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? As amended, your House file is ready to go as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Members, my introduction will be brief, but this is really about keeping promises. This is really about us as the legislature and the government fulfilling what we said we were going to do in programs to help companies that were going to carry out charters that we asked them to do. And this is in the biofuels incentive program. So when this legislation was put together, the idea was that companies could apply for this, and they had very rigorous steps and audits that they had to go through to prove that they were following these, and then there would be appropriations available for them to meet those through these incentives. That has been done by companies, that has been put together, but in our wisdom, we have stopped that, and the payments have stopped, and now we have companies sitting out there wondering what their next steps are, even though they're still carrying the charters of this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have two testifiers who can speak to this way more succinctly than I can. But what I want you to think about as you're doing this is, what is our word really worth? As we put programs together and we ask people to do them, they do them on the incentives that we lay out in trying to solve many of our energy crisis, and then we pull the rug out from under them. I don't think that's the right approach, and there's money to handle this. We can look at restoring this, so I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers, and
I'll start. Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Representative Kreshet. Again, I've got Brendan Jordan. Is that the first one up today? Mr. Jordan, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Baker and members. My name is Brendan Jordan. I am Vice President of Transportation and Fuels at the Great Plains Institute. I'm testifying in favor of House File 3217 on behalf of the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota, which my organization convenes and facilitates. The coalition brings together everyone involved in the bioeconomy value chain for collective decision making and action to educate, evaluate environmental impacts and benefits, and incentivize sustainable products to benefit our environment and grow our economy. We envision a thriving Minnesota bioeconomy based on bio-based products that benefit the environment, support communities, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Minnesota Bio Incentive Program, which is the subject of this bill, has a strong track record of boosting Minnesota's economy and creating value across the bioeconomy value chain. Additionally, and really importantly, this program only makes payments to companies after production has already started. We like to refer to it as a boondoggle-proof program. It's a low-risk, high-reward investment for the state. It is. There have been two separate studies by University of Minnesota Extension, the Center for Community Vitality. The second one, more recent one, found that for every dollar spent, the program has generated $407.10 for the state's economy and $8.90, again, per dollar invested in new tax collections. However, the program has been underfunded. This bill would allow the program to satisfy its obligations to claimants who have, again, already made investments in the state and achieve its intended goals by compensating companies that benefit the state and the environment. Thank you, members, for considering this legislation and for the opportunity to speak on it on behalf of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Appreciate your testimony. Next up, it looks like we have Tom Rodovich. Is that correct? Or Brian Werner? Mr. Werner? Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and continue.
Chair Baker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Werner, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association, or MBA. On behalf of our 9 producer member facilities, I appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony in support of House File 3217, a bill to fully fund the bioincentive program. We thank Representative Kreisha for bringing it forward. MBA members produce more from every kernel of corn than just traditional ethanol. They also manufacture several co-products, including dried distillers grains for animal feed, corn oil that goes to make biodiesel, renewable diesel, and sustainable aviation fuel, and most relevant to this bill, advanced biofuel known as corn kernel fiber ethanol. Corn kernel fiber ethanol is fermented from the non-edible fiber in the corn kernel rather than the sugars and starch. And as a cellulosic biofuel, it reduces life cycle greenhouse gas emissions by over 70% compared to gasoline. The intent of the Minnesota Bioincentive Program was to provide performance-based payments to encourage facilities to start new production of this lower carbon advanced biofuel. And many facilities responded by making investments, installing new equipment, utilizing new yeasts and enzymes, hiring more workers, and now produce corn kernel fiber ethanol. However, in recent years, reimbursement claims have outpaced appropriated funding, leading to partial reimbursements and unpaid claims. That's where this bill comes in. It would provide sufficient one-time funding to fulfill the state's commitment, fully reimburse all unpaid claims, and spur additional clean fuel production benefiting Minnesota's environment and economy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Werner, for your testimony. Maybe before either Mr. Jordan or Mr. Werner leave, is there any questions that anybody has for the two testifiers at the table at this point? We can have you come back if we need to that, if we have any further questions, but thank you. I have another testifier on the list. Is Mr. Rodovich here? Tom Rodovich, just want to make sure nobody else is here. Okay. Not seeing him. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll close testimony. To member questions. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Kreisha, the bill has not been heard in ag, and I guess before we would go forward, I'd want to make sure they'd be able to review it. Because of course we don't have expertise in the program. Are you expecting to or looking for ag committee review of the bill at some point?
Chair Pinto? I'm sorry, Chair Kreisha.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. If needed, everyone that I've talked to, Chair Anderson and Chair Torkelson as well, many people who are closely connected, they're very firmly behind this. They have been. If needed, I'll follow whatever path I need to get to. Sure. But as you know, timelines and deadlines where we are, I just need to get this moving.
Okay.
Chair Pinto, follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. I probably will certainly want to check in with Chair Vang as well, obviously, because I feel like we're a bit of disadvantage to evaluate the substance of it. One thing that does jump out at me, and maybe you can correct me, but it looks like the funding would be entirely retrospective. Like, it wouldn't change anybody's incentive to do anything going forward. It's just that these investments have been made, and you're saying that folks received pro rata payments or partial payments, that sort of thing, and this would then top them up, or maybe in some cases didn't get a payment they were hoping to get. We have many programs where the demand exceeds the funds available, like many, many. And so I'm just trying to understand why this program in particular, and also, and maybe one thing if you're saying going forward, because that would change incentives, but at this point, we're going to be spending dollars that are intended to increase investment, but then spending them on investments that have already been made, so it won't actually change anybody's behavior. Can you just help me understand that?
Chair Grisha?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Pinto. So let me start with a couple things. First of all, what you said, I heard you say, is we have many times where things exceed. And all that. The reality is we haven't fulfilled these payments. And I'm just asking to go back and keep get these individuals whole. They followed the process that the legislature laid out in front of them. That's what's sitting at my craw. This is righting the ship on something that we asked for industry to take care of, and then the legislature, and I don't think it's a good enough excuse personally for me to say, well, we do this all the time. We have lots of programs that run out of money and all that. Then we need to rethink how we're trying to incentivize companies. That's just a wrong way to approach this. And I don't care what industry that is. Going forward, this may not have any ramifications going forward, because maybe we do determine that once we've held these companies whole, that we've completed our fulfillment, that there isn't any more funding to go forward. I understand that. But we should at least get everybody up to what we committed to and then be able to go forward.
Was maybe just
sure,
quickly.
Yeah, sure.
So to appreciate, is it a legal obligation or like a moral obligation? I mean, because I guess I'm a little confused. Like, I mean, is there something in the law that you're saying the state violated, that the state was required to make payments and then payments weren't made? I mean, or is it just sort of you're saying that the companies had an expectation? I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Chair Grisha.
Yes. Yeah, I'll just say yes. I'll start there. I mean, if we're putting programs together, we pass bills and we promise funding for that, but then we don't fulfill those obligations, I don't know what realm that falls into, but to me, that's just wrong.
Yeah.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, so we can maybe talk more offline, but I could think there's a lot of areas I can think of in child welfare and many other areas where, you know, there's we enact programs and we certainly want to have as much funding as we possibly can for them. But I think from just the very limited information I have about the program, because it's not really in our budget area, but it seems like it's a program that, you know, it was clear each year there was a certain amount of money allocated to it. And when those funds ran out, they ran out. So in any case, clearly further conversations to be had, but thank you for making the committee aware of the program. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Other member questions at this point? Again, this is, I appreciate you bringing this to us because, again, I happen to have an issue very similar to this back with the Benson Biomass Plant, where they changed the contracts, changed everything well into the program, and it should never have been terminated 10 years before it was. And it cost a lot of investors a lot of money back in our area. So this is important that we do step up and we fulfill those obligations that we said we were going to do. So seeing no other member questions, Chair Grisha, final comments to your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chan. Thank you, members. So let me just read a couple of quick things. And as Chair Pinto was alluding, you know, if we're looking for ways to not fulfill some of the things we put together, and I understand that with programs all the time, I'm not buying into that, saying that's the right thing to do. This is a program that was put out there with bipartisan support, lots of good ideas, and has gone through all the rigors of auditing. I just want to read one thing from the OLA's fiscal year 24 report. Reviewing the AgriGrowth Research and Innovation Bioincentive Program to examine the policies and procedures, upon reviewing all the 55 payments for accuracy, eligibility, timeliness, and compliance with requirements, no significant items were found. Through all of those audits, these folks did exactly what they were asked to do in order to get this incentive, and we fell short of funding on that. However you want to look at that gap, but in my mind, what I'm bringing forward to you is, are we going to continue with the precedent of dangling a carrot and then pulling it back too soon? When we ask industry to respond to the problems that we see, I think the least we can do is follow through on here's the investments and here's the incentives that can follow for that. They're putting people, time, jobs. I mean, everything we talk about, workforce shortages, innovation, all of those we ask industry to do over and over and over, which creates investment and expenditures on their side. And then we say, my bad. I would hope you would consider this bill.
Thank you, Chair Grisha, for your bill. The chair will renew his motion that House File 3217, as amended, be laid over for further consideration. Members, all those in, we're just going to lay the bill over. So thank you. We don't need a vote on that. So thank you very much, Chair Kreshia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Next up, members, is House File 2252. Representative Anderson, if you'd please come forward. I don't see any amendments to this one. Okay. I was just looking for any amendments. I don't see any amendments, Representative Anderson. So the chair will move House File 2252 to the committee and to possibly the plan is to lay this bill over for further consideration. Representative Anderson, to your bill, House File 2252.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can I ask, do we have the...
in your packet, there should be a presentation.
I'm sorry.
There's a presentation in your packet. We can go over that when I turn it over to my testifiers, which I'm going to do quickly because this is very complicated. This is a public financing issue. The federal government allocates a dollar amount to every state of tax-exempt bonds that they can essentially do. And this legislature decides what caps and what different types of things can be used for those bonds. And so what I want to do is turn this over to the experts because they know this better than I do. So,
all right. Thank you so much. Now, you don't want to use the screener at all? We're just going to use sheet today in front of us?
Certainly. It's up to you. If you'd like to put it on the screen, that's fine.
If you've got it on your phone or can plug it in or not? Let's not worry about it then. Okay. So, members, you do have this packet in front of you. It was in your packets. I think there was some out there for the public as well to look at. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Paul Donna. I'm a public finance professional with D.A. Davidson and a tax-exempt bond expert. And so in your packet is the presentation on House File 2252. And what this is we're really targeting a modernization of Minnesota's private activity bond volume cap. We're proposing a modification that would ensure that the current federal funding authority aligns with the current demands of infrastructure and economic development projects across the state of Minnesota. What this bill does not do, it does not expand the authority, but instead modernizes it to meet the current demands. So on the second slide there, you can see that the existing formula, this was established decades ago, and it no longer reflects the actual demand that we are seeing, the state is seeing in projects across the state. The proposal realigns the existing allocations while remaining fully budget neutral and having no impact on state spending. The third slide there provides a little background on what private activity bonds are. It's a long-standing financing tool that was established by the federal government back in 1986. And it has largely remained unchanged. They finance projects brought forward by private companies or public companies, public institutions that derive, and these projects derive a public benefit. There's a public benefit attached to it that allows these projects to move forward. These bonds, because the interest on the debt is exempt from federal income tax, provides a lower cost of borrowing for these institutions that are using these bonds. It allows for these critical projects to pencil, to work, and to remain sustainable. And most importantly, the repayment of those bonds is on the full creditworthiness of the borrower, not on the state and not on the taxpayers of Minnesota. Slide four illustrates
if you could hold
what
up
our
the
current
number.
Framework
Mr. Donna,
here.
Sorry to interrupt. We don't have numbers on this. Do you want to just show us which page you're actually on now?
Oh,
page
sure. I'm on current framework. It's called
Minnesota's current allocation structure.
Historical use of CABs in Minnesota.
Thank you. That helps us a lot. Thank you.
You bet. So under our current law, we divide the annual volume cap at the federal government provides to us, we essentially set it aside in three buckets. There's the housing bucket, There's the small issuer manufacturer bucket, and then there's the public facilities bucket. At the beginning of July, if those buckets, if there's dollars of allocation in those buckets, then those dollars go into what's called the unified pool. And that unified pool has an order of preference, and housing is number one on that preference list. And so that happens after any of that unused authority. So on the next slide, what we're trying to illustrate is how we've utilized those various pools over time. Historically, housing has been the number one priority across the state, and it's reflected in the rules that the legislature has set out with how it's allocated. And those that allocation largely gets spent across the seven county metro. Contrast that with the small issuer pool for manufacturing projects. That's the next bucket. We have seen very, very little use. Less than 1% of the amount allocated to that bucket has been used. We can go back 20 years and look at the statistics, but less than 1%. And that's a factor really at the federal level. They have not changed the way that process works. And it's mainly very ineffective for use. The public facilities pool is a pool that's essentially supposed to be used for public-private purpose-type projects including clean water for wastewater cleanup, recycling-type projects, projects that benefit agriculture in the way of renewable energy, ag waste management, and solid waste-type disposal projects. That's the third bucket. Today, though, and why we're here, is that there's a mismatch of how these funds have been utilized over the years. That small issuer bucket remains underutilized. The public facilities bucket is the one that we have seen increasing demand across the years for those dollars, and there's very little dollars available for these projects. So the next slide, what we are proposing is the core change, and what we're looking at is reallocating dollars from the small issuer pool that initially receives about $12.75 million a year, and allocating those dollars to the public facilities pool. This will provide a balance and better align the demand for projects we see across the state for this type of funding. Again, the total volume cap allocation remains unchanged. So as far as policy impacts on the next slide, we are preserving housing as the top priority. The housing pool remains unchanged. We're expanding the public facilities pool to support the high demand projects that we're seeing for these necessary projects across the ag industry, waste processing, clean water, and recycling, and also broadband. Broadband falls into this pool under the federal government as well. And these projects, we feel, certainly are critical to Minnesota's competitiveness and quality of life. So in closing, on the last slide, essentially what House File 2252 will do is modernize the current allocation procedure, provide additional dollars for the public facilities pool by rebalancing it off of the small issuer pool. And with that, I conclude and certainly stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Donna, for your testimony. This is interesting stuff, and it's important stuff, and I want to make sure we get this in the right hands to the right committee. I know this has been a very sort of a tricky item to get everybody to understand this well. Even our nonpartisan is like, we didn't really study this one real hard, and I'm not going to put Ann on the spot here. But again, this is, we've had other members, other nonpartisan too, go, we need to look at this a little bit carefully. This is an important thing. So thank you for that clarification. Mm-hmm. I see we've got a few more folks on the testimony list for this. I'm sure if we need to have you come back, Mr. Donna, you'll be able to Absolutely. Do that for us too. So thank you for your testimony. I will call up Lucas at this point. Lucas Shostrom from the Minnesota Milk Association, thank you for being here. And again, Mr. Werner will be on deck to come up forward. So welcome to the testimony. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Also, thank you, Chair Pinto and committee members. My name is Lucas Shostrom, for the record, Executive Director of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. I want to thank Representative Anderson for bringing forward HF 2252, and I'm very, very happy that you allowed Mr. Donner to go first. currently, Minnesota's tax-exempt bond value cap is misaligned with the real-world demands of our agricultural and rural infrastructure. For the last 5 years, while 96% of our volume cap was used in housing, only 4% was supporting clean water, energy, or agriculture. As he said, the small issue pool intended for manufacturing and student loans remains constantly underutilized. So even with this year's allocation of $74.5 million to the small issue pool, history shows the utilization rate of just 1%. So that is capital sitting on the sidelines while dairy farmers and dairy processors struggle with high interest rates. Tax-exempt financing provides a 2 to 3% interest rate advantage, which equates to an annual savings of approximately $25,000 to $28,000 for every $1 million borrowed. HF 2252 reallocates these underutilized funds to increase the public facilities pool to $61.78 million. This simple statutory change, as was explained, will unlock private investment for these categories that my organization cares about. One, manure management. It was referenced ag waste, and that's an old term that USDA uses. It should probably be called agricultural gold. That's manure and manure facilities, manure management systems, and wastewater treatment. Renewable natural gas systems, which we are seeing more and more interest in, that convert manure into energy. Dairy processing infrastructure that requires significant clean water and utility upgrades. So this bill supports rural and agricultural communities without reducing the state's housing finance capacity. We urge you to support House File 2252 to help Minnesota's farmers invest in our state's future. Thank you, and let me know if there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Shostrom. Appreciate your testimony this morning. And Mr. Werner, if you could come back forward to the testifying table, please. Reintroduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Full and double duty today. Thank you. Chair Baker and members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Brian Werner. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association. MBA supports House File 2252, legislation to update and modernize Minnesota's allocation of federal tax-exempt bonding authority, and we thank Representative Anderson for bringing it forward. Since 2005, the overall carbon intensity, or CI score, of ethanol has decreased by 23%. And today, ethanol's life cycle greenhouse gas emissions are on average 46% lower than gasoline. But we know that there's more work to do because every producer member of MBA has committed to producing net zero ethanol by 2050. There are three primary ways we will get there. Number one, incorporating energy efficiency technologies that recycle steam and heat, installing wind and solar energy, and utilizing renewable natural gas from Lucas's members. Number two, capturing carbon dioxide from fermentation to process with green hydrogen to produce sustainable aviation fuel and zero carbon fertilizers. And number three, purchasing feedstocks grown with conservation practices and precision agriculture techniques. But each of these pathways requires significant upfront capital investment by facilities. By increasing access to tax-exempt financing for these types of low and zero carbon energy technologies, this bill will help achieve the state's climate goals and spur economic development. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Werner. That's all the testifiers I have on this bill. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I'll close testimony. Any member questions on this bill? Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm Representative McClendon to raise his hand too, but I'll go and then we'll go from there. So to your comment, Mr. Chair, earlier about sort of committee jurisdiction, I guess that's a concern that I have with the bill is that I don't quite see the connection with our committee's work. I would certainly support moving it to the Capital Investment Committee where they do have that expertise. As I am trying to understand the bill as you referenced, Mr. Chair, and it seems like what it does is essentially shifts potential funding from the one pool, from the small issue pool to another pool, and you're saying the small issue pool has rarely been used, but you know, for all I know, the Capital Investment Committee has a particular plan for that pool or doesn't, or it's just hard to evaluate the impact of that. I don't see otherwise what the connection is with our committee's jurisdiction. So
Chair Pinto, I'm going to pause for a second because I'd like to ask nonpartisan that question. I think it's a good reason.
Oh,
it's
good,
a very good
you.
Question you're asking
thank
today.
You.
So to Ms. Scholine.
Chair and members, Anna Scholine, House Research. I've talked to some of my colleagues in other areas, and we believe this ended up here because the private, the small issue, or the private activity for the small manufacturing, that we would be reducing the allocation for that, and so this committee that covers economic development might have an interest in that part of it. It doesn't change the housing part, so housing wouldn't necessarily have an interest in it, but the tax committee apparently might have some interest in this bill. I've been told that it is not the kind of bonds that the Capital Investment Committee is interested in. That this is what I cannot explain that part, but that is what the analysts in that area have said, that because it's dealing with federal tax exemption.
Thank you, Ms. Scholine, for that. Again, both chairs are kind of scratching their heads under the same thing. But maybe to, yes, Representative Anderson, maybe you can help us, Sarah, with, as the chief author.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Chair Pinto. So it was the big question, where does this go? Because it is. It's complicated. It's really a federal, it's just an allocation issue, and we're taking money out of one that's underutilized and put it into something that could use it. I don't think it's a tax issue. I'm on taxes, but we could go there. But in talking with some folks, ultimately this would end up potentially in a capital investment bill. And so maybe that's where this should go. And maybe we should take your advice on that. Chair Pinto, we could send it there. So.
You could, I mean, and Chair Pinto, to this, I mean, we've talked about this loosely, and again, I know we're after the deadline, so we'd have to maybe make some adjustments. I don't know, but to Chair Pinto, I mean, if this is the right pathway, I'm open to this.
Mr. Chair, my thinking was that I'm concerned about making a substantive decision for the committee, but I don't think that we have jurisdiction otherwise, and so my thinking had been we would just refer it. I mean, if the goal is to get through the committee, that's another way to get through the committee, is just refer it to the proper committee. Which I still would think would be capital investment, though I take what Ms. Scholine had to say. It does sound like maybe taxes has an interest as well, and then obviously that'd be up to those chairs. But that'd be my
and
thinking.
Mr. Chair, I would support that movement as well. I was struggling with what to do with this. Again, we'd have to have a rules exception for this. I think it's worth the ask, and again, if we've got both chairs that are asking for that, maybe it's something we can do. It just, again, this was a very short session. This got to the very end, and we think this needs to move along. I think that's what you're hearing is it makes a lot of sense what you're proposing today. Mm-hmm. I mean, increasing, public facility stuff is really important to us. Mm-hmm. Right-sizing the buckets is really important. Mm-hmm. Today's hearing has been very helpful for me to understand this much, much better. So I think that's something that we can do. So I don't know. Any other member questions? Rep Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. And I guess I'm going to chime in and say I'm going to cut this the other way, actually, that this housing is very central to our work, and understand that we're maybe scratching our heads around how does this exactly fit under this particular committee's jurisdiction. I think one group, not a couple groups, are missing here, and that's the small manufacturers, sounds like. Curious to know where they sit, but then also housing, serving on housing and having previously served on capital investment, and having a little heartburn that this isn't moving through those, especially with the tie-in to MHFA. But, well, this bill isn't changing the total bucket. You know, line 4.33 does reference that a $50 million would be set aside for public facility dollars, and at a time when we have 105,000 unit shortage in Minnesota. We just heard in the Housing Committee yesterday, workforce bill was manufacturer after manufacturer coming and talking about how we're trying to stand up or expand and scale up and grow, and we can't find anywhere within a 30-mile radius of communities for workers to live. This also ties into this committee with the reason we don't have housing is that there's no units, there's nowhere to live, right? There's the places that we do have, rent to own, are unaffordable. And three, there's massive wealth inequality, and that is something that I would have deep heartburn over moving this bill forward if it didn't move to housing or capital investment. So I'll cut it short there and just say, you know, you mentioned like there's a mismatch, and I'll just say that the state budget, we fund housing at 0.03%. And in the same way that to pencil and to work out projects here is the same thing what these housing dollars mean for workforce and affordable housing to preserve. And this bill also supports affordable projects, LIHTC, and those are really crucial and all in the same ecosystem. So I want to make sure we're not kind of like robbing Peter to pay Paul, and then we're actually caging ourselves into not having anywhere for our employers to live. So two questions, Chair, and to the author of the bill is just if we could find out how many units of housing have been brought online or preserved. I think that would be really clarifying for us to navigate where this bill might go next. But then also just the impact of what this substantive decision would do. And then to, yeah, if it'd be slated to go to capital investment or housing. So thank you.
Who wants to take that one? Representative Anderson or Mr. Donna? Yeah. Either way.
I've got a couple.
Go ahead.
Sure. Chair Baker and members, one point of clarification. The small issue pool will remain. There will be about when it flows through the formula and final allocation, there'll still be about $25 to $30 million in that pool, which is sufficient for at least two projects, because one project, it's limited to $10 million per manufacturing project. We can count on one hand the number of projects we've seen actually asking money for the small issue pool over the last 15 years. So I think that pool will remain intact and provide still dollars for those types of projects. To the question on housing, we thought through this bill very carefully because we knew the importance and the priority of housing across the state. And when I spoke to housing folks about this bill initially, they really liked our approach. I'll leave it at that. They really liked our approach and indicated to me that they would not oppose it because of our thoughtful approach going forward. Also, what's happened at the federal level has boosted our ability for affordable housing across the country. And with respect to the private activity bond allocation, LIHTC or 4% tax credit bonds, which fall in this pool, now you get a 4-for-$1. So you don't, for every, let's take a $10 million project that comes forward, you only need $2.5 million of allocation today versus the whole $10 million last year. So we've seen a boost in housing, and so that will help and keep and preserve the what I believe the demand for the low income and affordable housing across the state. So hopefully that's helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Donna. Rep. Klesalski, any follow-up to that?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Baker, and to our testifier and author. I'll just say that the landscape of federal impacts on housing and workforce housing, I think this side would have a very different agreement. But if we could get some of that data in, again, making sure that just on the record that we should think very seriously before moving this bill without going through the Housing and Capital Investment Committee.
Thank you. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding this correct, by doing what you're asking to do here, you would be able to actually do more housing projects. Is that correct?
Are you asking Mr. Donna or the other?
Either one, okay. Of them could answer it.
Yeah, either one. Mr. Donna.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill preserves the level of allocation for the housing. I couldn't speak that it would increase the number. At the federal level, they affected the allocation by changing some of their requirements that, all else being equal, there could be more housing, affordable housing projects utilizing the current allocation because of their change in legislation. But this bill does not impact negatively the housing allocation today.
One more.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Baker. If a person is seeking these dollars, where do they apply to get them? Is it an entity in the state or is it federal?
Mr. Donna.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the application goes to the state, and the state decides, evaluates the application, and is responsible for that allocation.
Representative Mecklen?
Do we know what department processes the applications and administers the funds?
Mr. Donna.
Mr. Chair, yes. That would be the Office of Management and Budget.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything further? Okay.
No, I'm good.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for hopping back in as I'm understanding the bill better. I think on page 4, that paragraph H at the bottom, as I read it, that could potentially have an impact on housing in that it would take $50 million that's currently in the unified pool, and that money may well not be available for the housing subpool, I guess, under the bill. This is, again, as somebody who's trying to catch up and understand the bill. But can you just clarify? It seems like that potentially could have an impact on housing.
Mr. Donna.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's a very good question. The process of allocating the unified pool, which any dollars that are still available come July 1, those leftover dollars go into the unified pool. There is a priority list. Housing remains the number one priority for those dollars in the unified pool. So,
okay. I may, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I guess I had heard some concerns from the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund relating to this, and I guess I'm also interested in the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency's position on it. But we may be at a point where I guess my thinking is if we were to move the bill without recommendation to capital investment, again, I'm still comfortable with the idea that this doesn't need to be in this committee's jurisdiction. So. Representative Anderson, do you get your wish to make it through this committee would be the proposal. And then I guess if housing or tax committees, if those chairs wanted to hear the bill, it'd be important to me and I suspect to many of my colleagues that they would get to. But it does seem like we know the bill has to have passed through capital investment. Mm-hmm. And so that might be an idea, Mr. Chair, as opposed to laying it over either way. But I have concerns with us sort of making a substantive decision about it in our committee because it's really not our expertise.
But just to, Mr. Chair, just to maybe possibly just move it along without a recommendation, is that maybe what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, that would be the motion, or could potentially be the motion to re-refer to Capital Investment Committee without recommendation, mm-hmm. and say it's not in our jurisdiction any longer, and then hand it off. Thanks.
What are your thoughts to that, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Chair Pinto and Chair Baker. That's fine. So. Again, we struggled with this too. So
yeah,
where does it go?
We're starting a little bit late, but we're going to get it going. This is an important bill, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. Again, any other member questions to this bill? I would actually, support that, Chair Pinto. If we want to do that, I think that we should change the initial motion of House File 2252, as presented, that we would not lay it over, but actually just pass it along to the Capital Investment Committee without recommendation, but just to pass it along to the committee for further, ideas. Just further, what is about this bill? It's I'm speechless. I mean, this is crazy. So it's a great bill. We just got to get it through the right committees and the right nonpartisans and the right people so that everybody that knows that this is moving forward, whether it's manufacturing, housing, let's make sure we get it right. Mm-hmm. But this is an important bill. I appreciate you bringing it forward. Representative Anderson, final comments on your bill.
No, thank you. And yet it's complicated, and even as someone who understands a lot, I don't, it's a little over my head. So I appreciate all the discussion, and Chair Pinto, I appreciate your advice, and we will hopefully move this to capital investment.
So, Chair Pinto, would you like to make that motion just so that we can support that, just to make that movement, that getting it forward?
Yes, and again, to repeat, it may be that housing or taxes, I suspect that they may well need to hear the bill, but we know that capital investment will need to, and so they'll address that later. But the motion would be to re-refer House File 2252 as amended to the Capital Investment Committee without recommendation.
Thank you. I would support that as well. Any member questions? I'm just going to do a voice vote on that. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That House file is on its way to Capital Investment. Thank you so much for your time
this
morning. Thanks. Thank you very much. Members, up next, we have our friends from Dieter coming up to talk about the Promise Act. We'll have a report for that program. You should have some information in your packet about this. I want to welcome Commissioner Verilek to the table, also Mr. McKinnon to the table, Mr. Bowdrey. Go ahead and get set up there when you're ready. Let's see. We'll get her fired up here. All right. Looks like we're up, Mr. Commissioner. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Verilek, welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Matt Verilek, and I serve as commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. And if you'd like, I can head right into PowerPoint.
Yeah, let's dive right into it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So, as you can see, the subject of our PowerPoint today is the Promise Act report, and specifically the grants portion of the Promise Act report, and acknowledging as well, of course, that you've already had a hearing on the program recently, and there was talk about the report being forthcoming, and so now we have that, and some of this will probably tread a little bit of the same ground, but as I do that, I will also attempt to fill in some of the blanks of the lines of questioning that I know you had in the hearing that I later watched. So first, a program overview, and I want to acknowledge that you all probably know this very well because, in fact, you all established the program, and we are implementing it according to the law as first written in the 2023 session and then amended both in 2024 and 2025. As you know, the program awards grants to legislatively named partners to provide financial assistance in the form of grants to eligible businesses that have been adversely affected by those factors. Again, noting that it also provides financial assistance in the form of loans via a different channel. In the case of the six initiative foundations that are named, they do both the grants and the loans. In the case of the metro area, which received a lot larger share of the money, the loans are handled by MEDA and the grants are handled by Neighborhood Development Center. As you can see, the sub-bullet there, priority went to those who had not received assistance under COVID relief programs. So the point was to target, number one, very small businesses with a revenue limit of, I think, $750,000, and the very small businesses that had not already received the support of several other programs that I think we list elsewhere in the report. So it was targeted. And then finally, the funds, as you see, can be used for working capital to support payroll expenses, rent, mortgage payments, utility bills, equipment, and similar expenses that occur in the regular course of business. So eligibility, big question. To be eligible, the applicants have to demonstrate in an application, along with supporting documentation, that they are a for-profit or a nonprofit that earns revenue in ways similar to businesses, and the vast majority are for-profit, but we have a later slide, I think, that shows the percentage by type, whether LLC, LLP, nonprofit, et cetera. They have to have primary business location operating in the state of Minnesota, and then they have to have operations in specific geographically defined locations that are in the law, as you wrote it. There is that gross revenue upper limit based on the prior taxable year. So again, it is small businesses. And then new in round two, as you can see, if the business location is the taxpayer's residence, the business has to have claimed and been allowed the deduction for home office expenses in the prior taxable year. And so that will change to some extent the types of businesses that are determined to be eligible in round two, but that was not in place for round one. So beyond just pure eligibility, then the preference requirements that kind of help to determine who is able to finally get awarded. The law requires preference be given to eligible applicants based on the applicant having received $10,000 or less in assistance from those other programs mentioned. If they receive more than $10,000, then they wouldn't be eligible or they would not get this preference point. And the applicant can demonstrate that their business experienced financial hardship. If everything is smooth sailing, they wouldn't be eligible, but if they can show either that they experienced a 10% decline in gross revenue compared to the previous tax year, and we say tax year partly because you have to provide us your tax forms to validate that. And secondly, or secondly, the applicant can demonstrate their business experience a decrease in net income of more than 0% for the prior year compared to what's on their taxes. So appropriations, how much is involved here? Total of $103 million. Again, this is the grants portion, I believe. You can see the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations received $16 million in total, and then $86.4 million appropriated to Neighborhood Development Center for the following areas. You can see it's broken down geographically, parts of North Minneapolis, parts of South Minneapolis, parts of St. Paul, and then added, I believe, in either 2024 or 2025, was a portion for the seven county metro suburbs. And would note, you know, this was a subject of the last hearing. Who decided the allocations? That was outside the scope of what Deed did. That was legislatively determined. And also, if you're wondering kind of how these numbers add up a little bit, the total allocation figures that we have on this slide include both the largest category, which is grants for the businesses, but also the administrative expenses that are provided to the intermediaries that we have to work through, as well as some money for technical assistance to applicant businesses. So I think the total amount for grants specifically is more like $93 million, and then the differential of the 103, maybe it's 94. But anyway, the differential is the admin and the TA. Deed has a much smaller portion for admin, given that it is the nonprofit intermediaries that are doing the vast amount of determinations on individual projects. We have an oversight function there, which we will talk about, but the resources that we have for the program are significantly smaller. Next, on to oversight, compliance, and risk mitigation. Don't know if any of you care about this. Just kidding. I know you do. We do also. I want to underscore that. And we have a number of measures that we're happy to get into details on about this. First, each partner organization creates and maintains their own portal for the program, and so the partners receive the applications directly and serve as the initial reviewers for the applicant. The portal also is, I think, how the applicant companies upload their documents, because there are a lot of documents involved. I've heard some commentary that you just fill out a one-page form and you're good to go. No, that is not the case. Many layers, many hoops that folks have to jump through to get this, all in the name of preserving the integrity of the program, so that folks can feel trust and confidence that the scarce taxpayer dollars allocated to this are being used wisely. So the review process features numerous steps to verify the information submitted, applicant identity, verifying business location, and reviewing tax documents. And again, we can talk about business location. The key is just that they have operations that they can verify within the eligible zone. If they should have operations elsewhere, that is fine too, but that could not be the basis for being deemed eligible. It's just that at the time of determination, they needed to have verifiable operations in the zone. So Deed also spot checks 10% of all determinations on the front end, I would say, and then we will also do spot checks later in the process. As it says here, we will audit businesses 12 months after the award, in addition to any referral suspected of misconduct. So let me just unpack this one a little bit, because it's multiple layers that Deed does, in addition to the multiple layers that the intermediaries do as well. So when the intermediaries have received the applications, vetted the applications, looked at whether or not they think it is eligible, if they have a group that they believe are eligible, they send them to us, and then we do the spot check on 10% of those to double check their work. And only then would we cut a check to the, I guess it's seven intermediaries for the grant program, for them to make the cut, to cut the checks to the small businesses. If our spot check showed that one of the determinations was incorrect, we would reserve the right to not make that payment and then take whatever other remedies were necessary. But I can tell you that the spot checks we've done of over 10% have shown high accuracy. Then each business that receives a grant has 12 months in which to use the dollars. at the end of the 12 months, we will then begin a process, and we're still, I think, in the 12-month window for round one. But at the end of the 12 months, we will then audit the process of did they use the dollars for eligible uses. So then they'll have to have receipts. Now, if the program had been designed by the legislature to be a forgivable loan program, or if it had been deed doing the grants directly on a reimbursable basis, which is how we do most of our workforce development grant making, it would be a different process. But that is what we have in this case, the way the program was designed by the legislature, and so we are following those steps. So spot checks on the front end, spot checks on the back end, and when questions are raised about any individual grantee, and questions have been raised perhaps by some of you and certainly by members of the media, we take all those seriously. We have a report fraud button on the website as well. We appreciate the extra scrutiny because, again, we see it as extra layers of protection against incorrect payments. And so if ever we get a credible question about individual grantees, then they get an extra look where we ask our intermediary partners to assemble the documents, perhaps collect additional documents, show us your work. How did you come to the conclusion that this was an eligible grantee? Again, happy to say that it's been a very high rate of accuracy. However, if we get any instance in which it was an incorrect payment, and that is possible, I won't claim that the multiple hoops that we force people to jump through, I won't claim they are impervious. If we have an improper payment, either for innocuous reasons or purposefully, you know, fraudulent reasons, number one, we would then seek to recover the funds from our intermediary, so the taxpayer is made whole. And if we found that it was done for potentially fraudulent purposes, we would make a referral to the BCA. And we might have more detail on this later in the presentation. I believe we do. But I know from the last hearing that there was a question about, okay, theoretically you can make those referrals, but are you actually? And we didn't have that information, you know, at our fingertips the last time, but in this case, I think we have it maybe later in the presentation. We've made, I believe, 76 referrals to BCA. When the nonprofit partners, the initiative foundations and NDC, when they flag something for us, we send them to a BCA. And my understanding from our team is that we don't filter them out. We send them all over to BCA for them to do their process. And again, we would seek to recapture the funds from the nonprofit intermediary, and then the nonprofit can potentially seek recovery of their funds so they're made whole, but the taxpayers are who we're seeking to protect, and that's why we would recover the money from the nonprofit. Steps in the application. To apply, the business has to provide lots of paperwork, 2 to 3 years of tax documentation, complete an application attesting at how they will use the funds and upload source documentation. And our government relations director, Bowdry, just yesterday reminded me of the terms in the contract between the nonprofit intermediaries and the businesses with penalties that they would apply if a business, you know, makes this attestation and then doesn't uphold what they committed to. So we are trying to, you know, on one hand, let this program do its work and not be unnecessarily burdensome to small businesses because, you know, we hear from all of you saying, hey, why hasn't this money gotten out faster? But at the same time, we also know that you want us to ensure integrity. We've known from day one that OLA would have interest in this, and so we are welcoming their audit because we need to show our work. And so that's the balance we're trying to strike. So then we would proceed through the identification and documentation verification process. Rather, the intermediaries would do so. If selected and verified as eligible, they would sign a contract with the partner organization. The partners then send the applicant's determination to us at Deed, and then we do that spot check of over 10% of those determinations to make sure that it appears they're being done accurately. We would then disperse the funds to the partner for all those that are legit. And again, if we flagged one that was not, we would not make that payment. And then the partner cuts the check to the business, and they have 12 months in which to spend it for eligible uses, and then they have to retain records for 6 years on their use of funds. Now, I will acknowledge that it's going to be hard for us when we are doing the back-end audit of how the dollars were actually used after 12 months. It's going to be hard because there's no requirement that the business be successful. I mean, that's impossible. Some of them might have gone out of business. Some of them might have moved. And so it could be hard to track some of them down. But to the best of our ability, we will seek those details because that's how the program was written. Further on fraud prevention, any application receiving the unable to verify authenticity was deemed ineligible and the application was rejected. So I know in the last hearing you again heard from those intermediaries that said we flagged X number, you know, at the Initiative Foundation in Central Minnesota. We flagged X number at the West Central Initiative, et cetera. So those were all payments that we did not make because they were flagged and then referred those over to BCA. Partner organizations submitted reports to Deed that received those flags. We refer them to our internal audit team and then they refer the cases over to BCA. Similar process, frankly, in other programs that Deed operates, such as UI and paid leave. The internal process is a little different, but the net result is similar. So during round one, our partners identified 76 applications as having responses or source documentation that could not be verified as authentic or potentially fraudulent. I don't think that's in the report. We just talk about the process in the report, but the number we wanted to give you here since we knew that was a question the last time. Program results. Through round one, 929 financial assistance grants totaling $16,312. And again, that is out of, what did we say, 93 or 94 million overall in the program. So I would concede it has been a slow and systematic process of getting those out for the reasons we've already discussed. Average gross revenue of the business receiving an award was pretty small, $188,000. Average award, $17,558. So, you know, 10% of the average gross revenue of the businesses and 92.2% went to businesses earning less than $500,000 in gross revenue, so really targeting very small businesses. Here you have detail on applications and awards by partner. First thing I'll note for you, you might say, if you look at the total applications column, and then the applications awarded, so successful applications, and then ineligible, those don't all add up, and that's because there's a whole other category that you could say are still in process. Maybe they didn't give us all the information we needed or that the nonprofit needed on the front end, and so maybe we're seeking additional information and haven't reached a full determination. But you can see the scale of the applications. And again, this is all round one, and we said we made in total something like 900 awards if you add up applications awarded column. And so you can see the demand was vastly higher. And also that we rejected a whole bunch for being ineligible for a variety of reasons, which, you know, again, hopefully gives some confidence on program integrity. Next, awards by business structure, and I'll say two, I think we're within the last three to four slides here in the prepared presentation. Awards by business structure, sole proprietorship, the most common at 39%, and then on down the line, I mentioned earlier nonprofits, those are at 5%. Next, we have most common businesses by industry. Mr. Chairman, I recall you had questions about NAICS codes in the last hearing. I believe, according to our team, we have now also posted those on the website as a transparency measure, as you had suggested. And then here, just to summarize them at a high level, you can see what the most common industry classifications were. And I think I mentioned this already, but because of that feature added for round two, that you have to have claimed and been awarded the home office exemption, this mix will likely change to some extent in round two, but round two is still underway, so we don't have those numbers in full. Next steps. This says Deed will audit 10% of determinations, so that's true for the on the back end part where we will look at how the dollars were spent. It is already true on an ongoing basis on the front end for whenever the nonprofits say, here are the batch that we think are eligible, we do our 10% spot check to validate there. We also conduct reevaluations of any business flagged as being potentially ineligible or suspected of fraud. So again, that's what we do when there are media reports. And I'm happy to say that in the vast majority of those cases, legitimate questions But then we've been able to validate that they were accurate payments. And I cannot make that guarantee in every instance, and we will always, you know, dig into each instance as warranted. But so far, it's been a high rate of accuracy. Grantees are asked to seek additional documentation to verify business location, and we're looking to implement additional technology to help screen business, because even though we are pleased that the accuracy has been high, of course, we're aiming for perfection, and we need to be adapting ourselves and getting stronger protections beyond what we already have, because we know that this program is a target for fraud, just as every program is, and the folks that are trying to do that are adapting, and so we have to as well. And so with that, my presentation is complete and would be happy to take any questions. And Deputy Commissioner McKinnon is here as well. He, of course, testified the last time and leads implementation of the program.
Thank you, Commissioner, for the report. I just have maybe a question or two, and then I'll open it up to some member questions. On your second or third slide called preference requirements, I'm a little confused about the second paragraph, and the applicant can demonstrate their business experience or decrease in net income at a 0% to prior year. So they didn't have to have a negative impact to be eligible for the grant. I thought that's typically what the requirements were for most folks to get state dollars, is that you had to be negatively impacted by the purpose of the program. Help me understand the 0% from prior year. It looks like you didn't have to be hurt by the initial surge, or not the surge, but actually the unrest. Help me understand why that was at a zero, Commissioner.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman and members. And number one, this is just the law as written by the legislature, so we're just doing what it says. But I believe the distinctions there are gross revenue in the first one that would have to be 10% or worse, or in the case of net income, it would have to be 0% or worse. So the fact that it says more than 0% might make you think that you could have a positive net revenue, but I believe what that means is that your net revenue went down.
It is a little bit unclear, and again, I want to take members back that this was a very unusual bill that came through the legislature back in 23. It did not go through the Workforce Committee at all in the Minnesota House. I think it was touched on a different bill, more on the economic development side of things, but again, this was a largely written bill at the very end of session, and it really came more of on the Senate side. So just there's a lot of questions to it, and that's why we're here. Mm-hmm. It's moving out. There was a lot of unanswered questions, so I just want to make sure we cover that. And again, with recent information with KSDP, some of their highlights, they did identify a few businesses that are questionable. I think maybe I want to understand, first of all, again, because I didn't hear the bill a lot back then, why were there zones that were not eligible for this amount? You know, again, most of greater Minnesota was covered. There was some carve-outs, if you will, around the state. Why was that initially said those footprints should not be included? Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. And again, I would steer this one back to the legislature making those decisions, and my interpretation is that it was to target the areas that were hit the hardest by those six factors that you all decided were important to look at, and so we are implementing it as written.
Thank you. Okay, and then again, as part of the report, then how did some of those businesses sort of get identified as to why they were maybe included? Why didn't they get identified, in your opinion?
Mr. Chairman, can you clarify the question?
So the report on KSDP had, again, a number of questions. They were mostly about the grants went out to businesses outside of the footprint that were eligible for this funding. Maybe I can ask it a little different way. Have you, as Deed, now been recognized, as you now became aware of it, have you looked into those particular questionable businesses that did receive funding that did not have a footprint in the area that was eligible? Have you looked into those yet at this point, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, yes, for many of them, and several others are ongoing. And so, again, we take all those seriously, and anyone else who raises credible questions, we take them seriously. And, in fact, KSTP is with us, and we just talked with them earlier today on this topic as well. So the question of location, it could be that a business operates in multiple locations, so having operations outside of the zone doesn't make you ineligible to operate inside. And I think that's not what has been asserted. The question is, did they have any legal operations inside the zone? It could also be that they had legal operations inside the zone at the time of determination, but then went out of business, or that they then moved outside the zone, all of which is allowed under the law. But if we find that they cannot substantiate that they had legal operations inside the zone, then that would be an incorrect payment, and we would seek that back.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to go to some member questions at this point. May come back to that. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Commissioner. My questions are start on page 14. I see the categories that are listed here for the most common businesses. They have codes, NAICS codes. The one I look at this report, there's something that sticks out when I look at every region of the state. And what that is the category that's listed as transportation and warehousing. On your report, it shows 344 awards. But when I analyze the data, 322 of those awards were in the 7-county Twin City area for that classification. 0 in West Central, 3 in Southwest, 4 in Southeast, 12 in Central, 2 in Northeastern Minnesota, and 1 in Northwest. So to me, when I look at data, I look at when there's outliers. Why? So then I further looked at who qualifies for transportation and warehousing. What kind of businesses would that be? Well, what I learned is that the non-emergency medical transportation qualifies in that classification. And we've seen a tremendous amount of concern in that category. In fact, the governor hired Optum for $2 million the end of 2025, did a significant investment, and we saw 30% less billed into the state immediately once it was being tracked. So my question is, we have the same amount of aging people that would use non-emergency transportation in the 7-county metro and greater Minnesota. We have a great discrepancy here in data that could be non-emergency transportation. I'm curious if you've looked at that to say, why? Is there such a significant, because the other categories, when I analyze them, look pretty similar for all the other categories that you list here, healthcare, retail, trade, recreational, educational services, real estate, construction. I don't see things standing out as much as in that category, and I'm curious if you have done a deep dive as to why.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. We have the information about what type of work each business does, and that's how you get the NAICS codes summation that you see there. And it could be that in round one, significant number of them were Uber drivers, for example, but that's where the change for round two comes into play with the home office exemption. And at the end of the day, we just have to follow the law as it's written. And so if they were eligible businesses, if there was no evidence of fraud or no other basis on which to deny them, I couldn't have, invented one.
Rep. Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Commissioner. So in a hypothetical, with the data that Optum found, and as far as fraudulent billing, if there was a non-emergency transportation provider that fraudulently billed the state through the medical assistance program, and if they received a promise grant, are you assuring us that they would be having that money pulled back to the state? You would take the loan back from the state if they were committing fraud through the MA billing that we found in Optum the end of 2025, because the promise grant started in 24.
Commissioner.
I believe if we had knowledge at the time of determination that they had committed that fraud, then they would not have been eligible under ours, because I presume that would mean they couldn't be legally registered with Secretary of State at that point, and so that would have been a disqualification.
Representative Zalesnikar, follow up.
Thank you, Chair Baker, and thank you, Commissioner. It just, the timelines, I think, are the promise grant started in 24. The audit from Optum was the end of 2012. Significant issues were flagged. Billing dropped by 30% instantly in 14 categories. We saved about $160 million just by doing basic accounting principles. So with that said, it's very possible that there were that there could be. I'm not saying there is. I think it's the job of Deed to look and see who's on this list, and if the state found any of them to be fraudulently billing, Optum knows. I can't see it. It's redacted. There's nothing of data that was given to us to say who they found, but you know who they found. So if you know who they found, somebody has that data. It's not anybody in this chamber that has that data. So somebody has that data, and then I would expect, and the taxpayers would expect, that you're going to stop, you would have already awarded the grant to the person. They didn't tell us they were embezzling money. We only found that through the Optum report. So then my expectation, I think all of us in this committee and the state, is that you're going to go get the money from the promise grant back from the person if they did commit fraud. Is that fair to say?
Commissioner?
I'm not sure that we have access to the full list, but I can find out whether that is the case. I guess I would also need to consult our folks to understand if we get information after the fact outside of the bounds of the program that would have made them ineligible to be legally registered, if we can use that. But I agree with you. We don't want fraudulent entities to benefit from the program. So I'm happy to, you know, look further into that.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner, I have a question, and then I'm going to go to Rep. Aikberg. Yesterday, we heard a bill here from Chair Frazier and Chair Zhang regarding just the Metro Surge potential grants, and we're working through those kind of things. In that bill, they had actually a good subdivision of fraud, the fraud deterrent measures. I think that was some, you know, it's only four or five lines in their bill. I don't have to, you don't have it in front of you, but again, I think what we have seen in recent days is four businesses that have identified that were clearly outside of the zone of what the eligible areas should have been awarded to. Again, one of them was Paradise Assisted Living in the Bloomington area. They're clearly located in that area, and they got $21,000. There's two or three other ones. Again, I think what I want to do is just right-size it. We understand we're not suggesting there was fraud. It hasn't been identified. We're not saying that. We are questioning everything about every program we have right now, and I think you've been very clear about that's a high-integrity issue for you and your department. The fraud deterrent measures that were talked about yesterday I think are helpful. Again, any applicant suspected of fraud must be reported to the Commissioner of Economic Development within 15 days of discovery. You must change those and bring those to the, you know, Bureau of BCA for potential charges. There's language in this bill from yesterday that I wish was in this one, the Promise Act. It wasn't. It seems like it's a little bit, you know, loosey-goosey on the end here as we look at it now. Phase one is about wrapped up. We are seeing some signals here clearly from the media reports that we've got problems outside of the eligible zones. Commissioner, I have said publicly that I think the Promise Act may be considered to be paused and figured out because we should get the fraud deterrent maybe inside this bill today. We can do that while we're in session. Is that something that you would recommend us doing to help you with your teeth maybe in the fraudulent deterrent measures that are being suggested here by yesterday's bill? Is that something that you could kind of get behind? We've got $70 million yet that has not been approved or actually allocated to small businesses under the current Promise Act program. Is that something you would like to see us do as a legislator, to maybe give you a chance to put some more of that fraud language in the Promise Act to move this thing forward, to give us all more assurances that fraud can be not seen in this program? Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for the question. Number one, the legislature wrote the law and designed it and then modified it in 24 and 25. And so if you modify it again, we are happy to engage in that discussion. And we are also happy to have as many fraud prevention tools as we can get, because I'm a taxpayer, we are all taxpayers, and we don't tolerate any fraud. And so that's the first part in terms of whether the legislature would choose to make adjustments. You know, we would welcome that conversation and we'll contribute to it. As for whether I think we need to pause this program, I do not. We understand that there are questions, but when we get those questions, we do a deeper dive. We examine our processes. Happy to say that in the vast majority of cases that we've looked at so far, everything has checked out. But I hold open the possibility that it will not always check out. And we know from other programs that sometimes, even after all the hoops, sometimes an improper payment gets through. And so then we have to activate those measures. But we do have the power to not make improper awards if we can see on the front end that they are problematic. We also already have the power to claw back dollars if something did get paid improperly, and we have the power which we use to make those criminal referrals. And so I feel good about the protections that we have in place now, plus the attitude that we bring at the department. I think there's been discussion about whether agencies have been sort of too accommodating. We're trying to strike a balance. We don't want to hassle anybody unnecessarily, but we know how much scrutiny this is all under. The media double checks our work. You all triple check our work. The OLA quadruple checks our work. We check our own work. And so we are really doing our level best to preserve the integrity of a good program that makes a big impact on businesses that are struggling.
Commissioner, has there been any money that's been clawed back so far to date?
Yes.
How much is that? Can you give us a rough idea?
I don't know with certainty, but I would say it is in the neighborhood of $10,000.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. On page 8 of, or slide 8 of your presentation, you talked about round one. Deeds Partners identified 76 applicants as being potentially fraudulent. On page 10 of the report, you have that same number under the paragraph titled Fraud Prevention Review. You talk about the 76. And then the last line says, the internal audit team then refers cases as appropriate to the BCA to investigate applications of potential fraud. So of those 76 flagged applications, how many of those were referred to the BCA?
Commissioner Verlich.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. And I keyed in on the same thing because as appropriate maybe gives the suggestion that we filter some out. And I guess we would maybe reserve the right to do so if we saw that there was an obvious explanation and we didn't need to kick it over. But my understanding from my team is that we have referred them all over.
Rep. Bakeberg.
And then how many of those 76 potentially fraudulent applications have been prosecuted?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. That part is outside of deeds control.
Representative Bakeberg.
How many of those 76 potentially fraudulent applications were referred to local law enforcement?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is that our role at the state level is to refer them to BCA and not to local.
Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you. So obviously there's significant concern around this program, and I just want to correct the record just very clearly. So multiple times the commissioner, you've said that the legislature has passed this law. So from my understanding, no one from the Republican side voted for this. So it was passed under the DFL trifecta in 2023. There are significant concerns that continue to be had. So I just want to make it clear that, yes, it was passed during 2023, but we did not vote for this. Now, we would obviously have ongoing conversations about how do we support our small businesses, but I would agree with Chair Baker that we need to put a pause on this because of the fraud concerns that are obviously there. And we talk a lot about process here. And Chair Baker very well said that the legislative process was not clearly followed when this was passed. So I would just caution us to say that it was a legislative thing? Yes, it was. The legislature passed it. But let's be honest about the makeup of the legislature at that time.
Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Commissioner. I'm sorry, I didn't hear a question, but go ahead.
Well, you're right. It was not a question. But if I may just
absolutely
respond. Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I just want to emphasize that the 76 that were flagged did not get payment. And questions have been raised, and then we do our deeper dive, and in the vast majority of those cases have been able to subsequently validate that they were correct determinations. And questions are going to continue to be raised, and we will continue to take them seriously to preserve the high integrity of this program. And so, you know, it's all part of the process, but we have multiple layers in place, mostly to prevent and then to respond appropriately afterward. And also, I do want to correct, as you did as well, I think there is apparently one case in which it's being pursued locally with law enforcement.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did the most of my highlighting and circling on your next step slides. And talking about reevaluations, asking for additional documents, looking at new technology, all of these things that, as we have looked at, as we've been finding some suspicions or questions about this program. So one of the things that DEED probably could do is to actually do more checks, more than just 10%. You talk about before, you know, the randomized checks, audits of 10% of the applications before, and then 12 months later on the back end. Maybe there could be some sort of more percentage of following up on the site visits. What is that something? You don't need the legislature to do that. If you're finding that we're having 76 applications, I know that there were tons of applications, but if we're finding these patterns that we've been bringing up, would you, can you, will you, as DEED, decide to not only increase the percentage of those that you're going to spot check ahead of time, but then increase your follow-up visits that, again, you don't need us as a legislature to do.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. I mean, in a way, we do need the legislature, though, because we have just a limited amount of admin dollars allocated to us relative to the nonprofits. And so I agree with you. We think that double-checking and triple-checking is important, and 10% is helpful. But it's only a sampling. And so if we could do more, I certainly would be interested in doing that. But also, I want to emphasize again, when we talk about the 76, those are payments that did not get made because the protections worked. When we talk about the 9 that were initially questioned by KSTP, we did then deeper diligence on those. And in those instances, they were determined to be correct. It will not be 100%, though. I want to acknowledge that. And so that's where, again, we can't just let it slide. We have to take the measures to claw it back. And in those cases, potentially make criminal referral, too, if the incorrect payment was made for a bad reason and not just a mistake.
Okay. Representative Zlesnikar, follow up. I'm sorry, Zlesnikar. Representative Mueller, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess then, as and just for further clarification for me, can you explain to me then what it looks like for DEED to do a re-evaluation of any business? What additional documents are you asking for? And what is this new technology that you are hoping to implement that's supposed to be more helpful? And that'll be my last question. Thank you.
Commissioner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Representative. And for the technology piece, I might invite my colleague, Deputy Commissioner McKinnon, to join me at the desk regarding the reevaluation. So when we have a question about location, how can it be that they have operations in one town that is outside the zone? If that's their one and only location and they have no legal operations inside the zone, then that's a problem. But if they have operations in multiple places, including in the zone, then they would be eligible. And so what we would do is say, what we are doing and have done on an active basis is go to the nonprofit intermediaries that do the determinations and say, number one, show us again all the documents they already provided, the business that is.
And then number two, if anything is missing or inadequate or we need more clarification, seek those additional documents and then have them, as I said before, sort of show us your work. What was the thought process here? Now, we have to engage in an ongoing dialogue with those nonprofit partners to interpret what does business location mean, which seems like a simple thing, but sometimes it can be tricky. And then looking at all that additional information, that's how we come to the conclusion. As far as additional measures, like we said, even though we think the current ones are good, we always want to get better. And so I think it's a Thomson Reuters technology that we use in other programs that we want to apply in this instance. And I would look to my colleague to elaborate on that if he can.
Welcome to the committee, Deputy Commissioner. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Kevin McKinnon, I'm a Deputy Commissioner for Economic Development. The question relates to the technology that we are in process of acquiring. It is called CLEAR. It's a Thomson Reuters product. Some of our other business units have established using it, like our paid family medical leave program. Essentially, it is a very in-depth review of an individual. And as you know, this program is very much an individual program. The identity of someone is what is in question here and of the business. And so this goes even deeper than the sources that we currently are aware of and currently are using. You know, for example, the Neighborhood Development Center uses a tool called Plaid, which is very familiar in the banking industry, and that's what the bankers all use to determine the identity of an individual. I shouldn't say all use, but many of them, I think, probably do. So we are acquiring that, and as a matter of fact, I think it was to your earlier question, can we increase the number of determinations that we look at? Absolutely we can, and I can tell you we are. And part of the reason that we are is that some of these things are coming back that are making us go back to NDC to reevaluate the process. So so that is in process as well.
Yep. Thank you. Quick follow-up, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Thank you for the very detailed response. In none of the answers you gave me was I drove out to the business to find it or see it or talk to the human being that runs it. So is that something that Deed does? Do they actually get into a car, drive, find said business, said human, and talk to that person?
Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, we will do that eventually on the 10% that we talk about. So that is part of our ultimate audit process. On the back end where we're collecting receipts and those types of things. Can we do that? Absolutely. Is there a different method of communication and or how we do it? Yes. On the front end, what I would say is that there are two funds that the grantees have access to. One is the administrative piece, which helps you obviously do all the back end work, but there's also the technical assistance side. So a lot of the applicants and a lot of the folks who were already awarded may already be clients of some of not only our existing grantees, but many of their partners. So there is that personal relationship. I could probably speak for most of the people in the foundation side of Greater Minnesota. I mean, I think most there's 40 wards, you know, there's 50 wards. You probably know some of these people, some of the businesses, et cetera. So that is part of the initial application process, not only going through the Plaid identity types of things, and whether it's over Zoom, whether it's in person. So there is some in person at the start as well. But we eventually, and maybe for some of you, if we're having to go into your districts or meet with your businesses, you may hear from businesses that we are going on site to and asking asking for information from. They should have it. It's in their contracts that they're required to have it. So it should be an easy process, but we will see.
So, Deputy Commissioner, I'm just going to get right to it, too, because we've got limited time here. We've got three other question members that want to ask a question. You said eventually you're going to get to some of those businesses that maybe you're wondering about or you're doing a look in. The four that have been identified publicly, have you yet visited those businesses to confirm are they legitimate or not at this point? Kind of a quick answer, if we could.
Mr. Chair, we are in the process of reevaluating those four businesses.
Okay.
That's a no. And it will continue, and NDC is also in the process of reevaluating those to us. And if it is determined that that these were ineligible applicants that were awarded funding, there are a couple steps that we would take. One is we could go out there. Two, there are legal steps that we all could take to recoup the money that we will take.
Thank you. All right, Representative Wayne Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Make it fairly quick. Question I have is, originally you said if fraud is found out, you claw back the money, right, from the partner that you have. Thank you. So, but if they fail, you don't take any money back, correct? I mean, there's no money to take back. My question is the partners get paid a fee for administering and all this stuff, correct? So what incentive do they have to only give money out to businesses that will succeed? Because we all know under a certain, like businesses under 5 years old have a huge high percentage of failure. So my question is, how much money is going out to businesses that we're not going to succeed no matter what?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. One clarification, we would claw the money back from the nonprofits, so it's their balance sheet that we're looking at, and they are healthy. It's up to them if they want to try to get the money back from the small business to make themselves whole, but we will protect the taxpayer by getting the money from the nonprofits. And you're right that we are paying them per the law for admin, for them doing the work of delivering the program. And so I guess in an extreme circumstance, we could hold back some of the admin payment in the first place as a means of getting our money. But so far, I think, as I mentioned, we're talking about something on the order of $10,000 in a very large program. That is small. And $10,000 is relatively small compared to the health of those nonprofits and their ability to repay us. Just
one follow-up. Thank you. One follow-up, quick follow-up.
Thank you. Just so I want to clarify that no matter what, if the money was not used and the business is not open or existing, the money does come back to Deed and back to the taxpayers, and the partners are the ones that take the risk.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, actually. If the business closes, that's okay. We do not wish for that to be the case, but them continuing to exist is not required in the law. And as you said, business is risky. Many of them do go out of business. What we are required by the law to determine is, are they eligible at the time of application? And if so, then payment gets made, and if they subsequently go out of business, we regret that, but that's not in our control, and it's also not a basis to claw the money back. We would claw back in a case of fraud.
Then,
Representative Johnson,
so then
quick follow-up, because we got to be done, members, at 9, we have 10 o'clock.
The question still remains, then, what incentive is it for the partners to make sure they're vetting the businesses that they are giving out the grants to?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they are making determinations based on the criteria in the law, and I think long-term success prospects, I'm not aware that that's written into the law, and so we couldn't make decisions on that basis in a legal way. We just have to decide, are you legit? Are you in the zone? Have you experienced those hardships? And if so, then you're eligible.
Thank you. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to correct the record on something, this program actually did pass through the House. It received committee hearings under a different name. I believe it's called Empowering Enterprise. I may be slightly wrong. The Empowering Enterprise Program, and was a quite similar program. There was something similar out of the Senate. This is in 2023. And then a reminder, members, that then our committee in 2025 invested more funds into the program, expanded in some ways, limited eligibility in other ways. So it's something, I guess there's nothing unusual about a program having been passed in 2017, 2018. There was all GOP legislature, laws passed then, so nothing unusual here in that way. The goal of the program was to help small businesses recover, help key corridors in our communities to thrive. And fraud, of course, is unacceptable in any of our programs. In the case of this program, any dollar going to fraud is a dollar not going to that really important goal. And credible allegations of fraud should be thoroughly investigated. I know as a prosecutor, I think others as well would know just in common sense, investigations don't have preordained outcomes. Like, it sounds like the agency looked into some of the businesses identified in media reports, found that actually things were kosher there, things were going okay. We want to make sure we continue to look into that. I'm glad you're using CLEAR. I'm familiar with that in my work as well. And then anybody who's found or committed fraud should be held accountable. I'm glad you've referred to the BCA. And if there are charges that come out of that, that's great. If it turns out there's no charges, that doesn't mean anything was wrong. And if the BCA looked into it, it probably means that, in fact, the charges were not warranted. So I'm glad you're looking into this. It's an important topic. And thank you, Chair, for giving time for it.
Thank you. Again, the bill was much different than it was at the end when it came back from the omnibus bill. It was not the same. It was a larger number. It was very different. So, again, we can get into the semantics about how that all worked out. But, and again, it is what it is. It passed the legislation at that time. We're trying to follow the rule of what taxpayers are demanding from us. We appreciate you coming here today because there's a lot of questions. There's more questions likely coming after this, after our session. We have to rely on the agency to follow up on this thing very hard, very clear, because, again, we're finding more and more from this, from a lot of these programs, not just this one, again. And I want to make it clear, we don't think that our partners out there are not doing a good job in vetting out the dollars. They're doing everything they can. There's a good system. But when we get them and they come through as clearly obvious areas of the footprint they should not have been allowed to get funds in, we got to jump on that right away. I hope DEED has got the car running when they need to. You get in and go check it out right away, because we've got to stop the fraud. If there's the fraud out there, we just have to make sure that everybody is on top of that. So we thank you for coming forward. We thank you for the report today. Members, that's all we have today. Anything for next week yet, Chair Pinto? I know the world.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so on Tuesday, we expect to be hearing the governor's budget proposals in our area, as well as there's an idea Chair Baker and I have been working on. We know there's a lot of concern about healthcare workforce, and so a proposal for a program related to that for consideration. That's all. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair. With that, members, we have completed our agenda. We are adjourned.